Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 40% of food is wasted every year in the United States. We know that a lot of food is thrown away, but we don't necessarily know the specifics. This month, researchers at the Natural Resources Defense Council will begin a detailed study looking at what kind of food is wasted in Nashville, Denver, and New York. Researchers also plan to go through the trash. According to a report from NRDC in 2012, more than 20 pounds of food per person is thrown away every month. That totals $165 billion a year. Almost all of that uneaten food ends up rotting in landfills, where it accounts for almost 25% of U.S. methane emissions. If we reduce that waste by just 25%, we could feed more than 25 million Americans every year. And this is at a time when one in six struggle to put enough food on the table. Tackling food waste requires closing the gap along the entire supply chain, from farmers to retailers to all of us. And a number of organizations are working to do just that and raise awareness. Today we're joined by Dana Gunders, senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council and leader of the group's work on reducing food waste. Dana recently published the Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, a guide to eating well and saving money by wasting less food. She's also behind the recently launched Save the Food National Ad Council media campaign. And Dana Gunders joins us on the line from Berkeley. Hi, Dana. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rose.
Great to have you. Thank you. We're also joined by Alex Stroob, Director of Marketing and Business Development at Imperfect, a home and office produce delivery service focused on providing affordable fruits and vegetables. They do this by sourcing, quote, ugly fruits and vegetables that usually go to waste. Imperfect just celebrated their one-year anniversary, and they saved half a million pounds of fruits and vegetables. And full disclosure, I've been getting their fruits and veggies for about 2 months now. I just got my latest box this morning. Wednesdays are always fun because the box just ends up right on your doorstep. Hi, Alex. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So, Dana, I want to start off with you. You've done a lot of work on this issue, and it's so interesting that we know that 40% of food is wasted every year, but we don't know the details. First off, how do we know that 40% of food goes in the trash every year?
That's a great question, and I think it gets to the reason we're doing this research. So, all of the estimates out there about how much food we waste are very rough and gross, and they're done at a national level. So that 40% number is an estimate that they arrived at the National Institutes of Health by looking at the calories in our food supply after imports and exports, and then comparing those with the calories they think people eat. And they found a 40% differential, and they said, well, if people aren't eating those calories, they must be getting thrown away.
Hmm.
There are some other analyses that are done by weight more, where they look at, you know, how much they think people buy and by weight and how much they think they eat, and they compare those. And ultimately, they wind up being somewhat similar in terms of the numbers being somewhere between 30 and 40%.
And this month, researchers at the NRDC will begin looking at the specifics, looking at what kind of food is wasted in Nashville, Denver, and New York. And I understand that researchers are also planning to go through the trash bins to find out what kind of food is being thrown away.
That's right. So at this point, you know, some cities do analyze their waste, but typically they divide it into big categories like, you know, this much plastic and this much is food. And food often is the number one product going into their landfills. What we are trying to do with this project is get a much better resolution of data and really understand, you know, what types of food are being thrown out, how much of the food that's being thrown out is edible, and versus how much are just scraps like bones and peels and couldn't be eaten. And what we can do with that information is then understand how much could potentially have been avoided. We'll also be asking questions about why. We'll be having the participants of the study actually complete kitchen diaries where they fill out what they're eating and how much winds up going to waste through the course of a week. And then following that, we will be comparing that with what we find in their garbage cans, because one thing we know is that people tend to really underestimate how much food they're wasting.
Now, Alex, what kind of blows my mind when I get the imperfect box every week. So you can choose organic or conventional, mm-hmm. the size of the box. What I love about imperfect is you can decide what you want and what you don't want. So if green peppers, for example, are on the list, you can say you don't want them, but I want 5 cantaloupe, for example. Now, when I get the box, I'm amazed that this food would go in the trash if I hadn't ordered or imperfect didn't exist. Can you talk about why that happens?
Absolutely. And it's actually the number one comment we get from our customers is, I wanted that two-legged carrot, or I wanted this absurdly curvy zucchini and something that's really wacky. And it's not that. You see a small scar on an orange. You see a peach that's just maybe a little smaller than a peach you would normally see, or one that's a little bigger than you would normally see. That's how absurd the food standards are in terms of sizing and scarring and what would qualify something as a number one product versus a number two. And so that's the stuff that we're getting in our boxes.
Who sets these food standards? Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, it kind of spans a few groups. So some of it is set actually by like food groups, almost like a lobbyist group. And so that would say that the Farmer Association has said, okay, well, a number one cauliflower is creamy white. It is this size, and that's the standard we want set. And a lot of that has actually come from kind of like big ag, because that's how they've made their money, right? It's saying that we can grow this perfect product. And so it kind of elbows out all the other guys. It's also just kind of, you know, a lot of that is set by retail of what they want in their stores. They want their displays to look beautiful. And we hear that, but, you know, I don't think it gives the consumer the chance to make that choice. The choice is being made for them.
And Dana, we will talk about why food is wasted. We'll also talk about the supply chain, but let's specifically focus on this right now, perfectly edible food that is being wasted. Can you tell us more about this and piggyback off of what Alex just said about these standards that are set?
Sure. What grocery stores have found through their research is that people tend to choose their grocery store by the produce section. And so they really want their produce section to look beautiful. And they've also found that consumers who are standing there with, you know, a scarred orange and a non-scarred orange will choose the non-scarred orange. But it's gotten a little bit crazy. And so, you know, it's difficult to find a scarred orange in the grocery store. So the grocery stores are, in their purchasing orders, specifying that they want produce that looks a particular way. And that's excluding produce that, you know, has these little blemishes. And, you know, for some products, there are other options like processing. But for many products, they actually just get skipped over in the field or pulled out of the processing line and, you know, wind up going to waste, wind up going to animal feed. But it's often perfectly nutritious, good product.
And, Alex, can you talk about the process involved in getting this food directly from the farmers?
Yep.
How does that work?
Yeah. So we work with, right now, we've got kind of a roster of about 50 farmers that we work with. And they, you know, we reach out to them every week and say, hey, what do you have? You know, what didn't look right? What, you know, can't you sell? And they let us know kind of what sort of product. It's all fully seasonal, right? It's what they're growing. And then we also get calls all the time. I think actually a few months ago, we got a random phone call to our office from a farm in New Jersey saying, I have all these strawberries. Can you take them? I can't sell them and they're perfectly good. And unfortunately, we couldn't. And so what we're taking is such a small chunk of what's out there. So supply is never going to be the issue until we actually make some real changes in the system.
Do you mostly work with California farmers?
Yep, about 95%.
And you deliver all over the Bay Area?
Yep.
And so again, full disclosure, I get a box of imperfect every week. And how it works is you get an email on Friday. There's a list of produce and you can choose what you want and what you don't want. You can add more or less and you can order a small, medium or large box and then it's delivered to you every week. There's a $5 delivery charge. What are you hearing from farmers? I mean, because I've never heard of a service like this. I think this is the first one.
Yeah, especially on the organic farming side, it's really positive. This is, you know, an income stream that they weren't otherwise capturing. Right? They weren't making any money on this product. So
what were they doing? Because sometimes I get a carrot like with two legs.
Yeah.
I don't understand why these cantaloupe. I don't understand why half the box
can't
be sold.
I mean, they're so good.
They almost look perfect.
Yeah.
What were the farmers doing with those fruits and veggies before Imperfect came around?
It really depends. So some product actually does have, like Dana mentioned, a processor market. So carrots and apples are a good example of two pieces of produce that might have gone to kind of processing. So like apple juice or baby carrots even. But for the most part, and what we've kind of just heard anecdotally and you know what the numbers are showing, is it might go in a landfill. It might go to compost. It might even just stay in the field and never be harvested because they know, you know, they have to pay labor costs to extract that and they're not going to make money on it. So they're actually just spending money to put something in compost inevitably. So it can go to kind of a various source of places which might not be going into human consumption.
Right. Dana, what are your thoughts on Imperfect's model?
Oh, I love it. I was so excited when they first got going. And I think there is huge potential. And to your point, it's really hard to tell the difference. You know, I once had a peach farmer tell me that in the middle of the season, he has about 200,000 pounds of peaches and plums and other stone fruit that he can't sell. And he sends about 100,000 of that each week to the food bank. But then there's another 100,000 that he just literally, like, the food bank can only take so much. And what he said about all of that was, if you looked at them, you wouldn't be able to tell me what's wrong with 8 out of 10 of them. So I think there's huge opportunity. You know, we've been doing some research to try to get a handle on how much of this product is out there, right? Like how much perfectly good product is going to waste on farms that could be captured and eaten. You know, it's rough. It really varies by crop. It varies by season. But, you know, sometimes it's 20-30% of the crop.
20-30%.
Yeah.
Dana Gunders is senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council and leader of the organization's work on reducing food waste. And Alex Strube is director of marketing and business development at Imperfect. It's a home and office produce delivery service focused on providing affordable fruits and vegetables. They source, quote, ugly fruits and veggies that would usually go to waste, and they deliver all over the Bay Area. They just celebrated their year anniversary, and they have saved over 500,000 pounds of food. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. This issue is starting to get a lot more attention. So what are your thoughts on food waste? And is this something that you think about a lot? A whopping 40% of the food produced in the United States does not get eaten. That's more than 20 pounds of food per person every single month. We'd love to hear from you. 866. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. And since this is getting more attention, has awareness changed your ideas about food and how you purchase food? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. So Dana, we talked a little bit about how perfectly edible fruits and vegetables are thrown away. Can you talk a bit more about why other food is thrown in the trash?
Sure. Believe it or not, the largest source of food being thrown out is us, consumers, collectively around the country, kind of just letting food go bad in our fridge, making too much, not eating the potatoes on the breakfast platter. Consumers collectively represent the biggest source. And when you think about why that happens, you don't have to look much further than the last week of your life to probably get some idea, right? You went to the store, you thought you were going to cook, you had all these grand ambitions for what you were going to do for the week, and then life happened, and by Tuesday you're throwing a frozen pizza in the oven, and you just don't always, life doesn't go as planned. So I think that's part of it. We're not really that realistic when we're in the grocery store about how much food we're really going to eat and how we're going to manage our food. And the other thing is that I think we really like to have our options. So we will go to the store and buy stuff just so that we have the option of eating it, but oftentimes don't actually get around to doing that or aren't in the mood.
Do we know how this worked or what it looked like, say, 10, 20, 30 years ago? Because I'm wondering how, you know, big stores like Costco, how that's changed the way our relationship with food and how much we buy.
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, we waste about 50% more food now per person around the country than we did in the 70s.
Wow,
50%. So we're seeing a tremendous increase. And I do think portion sizes in general are a big part of that problem. And it's both the portions we're purchasing in as well as the portions we're being served in restaurants. And absolutely, you know, the big box store, buying in bulk, bringing it, you know, filling our car and filling our refrigerator does not lead to optimal food management in the end, right? Because we can't really see what's in there. Maybe we didn't need six peppers, we just needed two, and now we're stuck with these other four we're not sure what to do with. What I think is interesting is that we're spending a lot of money to throw food out. And, you know, we're so price sensitive when we're in the store, and 5 cents will sway us one way or the other, even if it's 5 cents per ounce when we're buying, you know, a lot more than we need. But then we get home and that math kind of goes out the window. And the average family is spending around $1,500 per year on food that they don't eat.
Hmm. And, Alex, it's amazing to think that 50% more food is wasted today than in the 1970s. What are your thoughts on that, and what will it take to kind of, I guess it would require a cultural shift, really,
yeah.
A shift in thinking.
Absolutely. And here's a little plug for Dana's book, because it does, I think it's a lot of, there's a lot of tips in there that maybe people practiced back in the 70s, but kind of have forgotten at this point. Like an egg, how do you know whether it's still good? And if you can put it in water and it sinks, you can eat it. And if it floats, throw it away. But now I think we look at those eggs and we say, oh, it's past the expiration date, and okay, see ya, and it goes into the trash or compost if you're even lucky. And I think it's a lot around education. I think another thing that and Dana, I would love your perspective on this actually, is around cooking. I think a lot of people now don't really know how to cook. They have those four extra peppers and they don't know that you can, what can you do with them? And there isn't a recipe on Food 52 that says exactly four peppers, how to execute. Do you know how to double it? Do you know how to just throw it in a stir fry? That sort of stuff. So I don't know, Dana, have you kind of like looked into any of the like cooking schools or even just people knowing how to cook and use the food that's in their fridge?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a huge component. You know, as over time we've become more distant from our kitchens and from cooking and from all the knowledge that goes along with that. So, you know, oftentimes people will talk about their grandparents and how, you know, maybe their grandmother would use chicken three ways and then use the bones to cook stock, or you know, really be able to manage the food well. And it takes cooking skills to do that. And that's absolutely and around the cultural shift as well. I'm glad you brought that up, Rose, because I think as a culture, we've come to be fairly numb to the idea of throwing food out. And, you know, I could walk down the street and throw half a sandwich on the sidewalk, and people would think I'm crazy because that's littering. But if I were to throw a half sandwich in the garbage, they would not think as much of it. And, you know, we really need to shift that paradigm. And actually, NRDC, what we've partnered with the Ad Council to launch this national media campaign where we are trying to shift the culture there. It's called Save the Food. And a lot of the information that we're giving at SaveTheFood.com is very specific kitchen knowledge. So what do you do with those peppers? Can you freeze them? Can you pickle them? Can you eat the stem? Can you not eat the stem? You know, just very hands-on information. And also in my book, I have 85 different products where you can look up exactly how best to store them, ideas for how to use them up. You know, if it has brown spots, can you still eat it? And just some of that really detailed knowledge that it boils down to, really.
Well, Dana, we have a caller who would like to talk about your book. Let's hear from Pat in Berkeley. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the show. Hello, Pat. We're trying to get Pat.
Your book.
There you go.
Hello.
Hi, Pat.
Hi. I wanted to say that I first got Dana's book at the library in Berkeley, and I was so impressed by it that I went out and bought it. And I'm getting ready to move to Sacramento to take care of my 93-year-old mom. And I know that she wastes food. And I do, too. I think everyone does. Mm-hmm. But this book has been so helpful in making me rethink about how I use food and, like, taking food that's starting to go to the back of the fridge and bring it to the front so I don't waste it. That sort of thing. It's a wonderful book. I was really impressed.
Well, thank you for calling in. And again, the name of Dana Gunder's book is Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, A Guide to Eating Well and Saving Money by Wasting Less Food. There's another easy tip. You can go online. For example, Imperfect is, I got these massive zucchinis last week and I thought, what am I going to do with this? I found a great recipe for zucchini soup. And I made a massive pot. I mean, it's so easy to find recipes online now.
Oh, yeah.
So, so easy. So thank you so much for calling in, Pat. We should maybe do a show about cooking. Let's go next to Wilkin, calling from the Alameda County Food Bank. Hi, Wilkin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. I applaud Dana. I applaud the topic that you're so passionately talking about today along with the panel. And I just want to say that the Alameda County Community Food Bank here in Oakland has been in food recovery for over 31 years. One of the strong relationships we have is with an Oakland-based organization called the California Association of Food Banks. And this is an organization that has partnered with farmers and growers up and down California to really start harvesting that second quality or crop that just didn't make it to the stores. They found a way to pay a value-added fee to harvest the second quality or coals and provide it to the 40 food banks up and down California. So that has been a big plus for food banks. Some of the other efforts that we're doing to help with this drive to really reduce landfill are establishing a program where our member agencies, whether they're soup kitchens or pantries or even a mom-and-pop church, have the ability to partner with a huge retailer in their immediate vicinity, whether it's a Target, a Lucky's, or a Walmart, and go in up to 5 days a week and quote-unquote rescue food that otherwise used to be earmarked for a landfill. So that's been a big boon, and that has contributed and saved 4,000 pounds of food in this last fiscal year for the food bank.
Wow. And Wilkin, we have to go to break soon, but I'm just curious. We haven't done a show on food banks in a while. What are you seeing in terms of demand right now?
Well, I think the 1 in 6 need is it's still prevalent. Here in the Alameda County, it's even more strict at 1 in 5.
Wow.
But that shows me we've grown our food distribution by 11% from that previous year, and yet the need is intensified. I think a lot for Alameda County has to do with the fact that, we need support with people getting jobs here, and the cost of living is really impacting individuals and where they can spend their money.
Right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Wilkin. I'm going to add a food bank show to my list. And Dana, before we let you go, what's one of a major policy change you'd like to see that would tackle this issue?
You know, the first policy change we're seeking is to have the date labels on food be more standardized. Many people think that those date labels mean that food is bad or should be thrown out or is unsafe, and that's absolutely not true. They really are just indicators of when the food is at its best quality, and you know, it's the manufacturer's best guess at when they stand by their quality. So we're looking for a more kind of standardized, regulated system around that so that we can really clarify for consumers what those dates do and don't mean.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back to talk about your Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. Maybe we should do a show about cooking.
Sounds fabulous. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you, Dana. That's Dana Gunder, Senior Scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council and leader of the organization's work on reducing food waste. Again, her book is Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, A Guide to Eating Well and Saving Money by Wasting Less Food. And sticking around with us for the rest of the hour is Alex Strube, Director of Marketing and Business Development at Imperfect. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. Mm-hmm.
If you've discovered KALW in 2016, please do your part to keep this unique community resource strong and growing. Become a new member of KALW with an end-of-year contribution at kalw.org. We welcome you and value your support.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about food waste. Luckily, this is an issue that is getting a lot more attention. 40% of food is wasted every year in the United States. That's 20 pounds of food per person thrown away every month. Almost all of that food ends up rotting in landfills. Luckily, here in San Francisco, we can compost anything that's edible. You can throw in that green bin, but that accounts for, well, at least in the landfill, it accounts for 25% of U.S. methane emissions. If we reduce that waste by 25%, we could feed more than 25 million Americans every year. And joining us today is Alex Stroop, Director of Marketing and Business Development at Imperfect, a home and office produce delivery service that provides affordable fruits and vegetables. They're considered ugly, and they would usually go to waste. They deliver all over the Bay Area. And now I would like to welcome Nicole Civita to the show. Nicole is director of the Food Recovery Project and an affiliated professor with the University of Arkansas School of Law's Program in Agricultural and Food Law. That's a mouthful. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So before the break, I asked Dana Gunders with the NRDC what policy change is at the top of her list. And she said she would like date labels on food to be more standardized. And I'm guessing that this might be news to some people that the date labels in many cases are misleading. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's an incredible report by the Harvard Food Law and Policy Clinic, a group that I work with on a lot of the publications the Food Recovery Project does. And they talk about sort of the, and actually Dana worked on that report as well, they talk about the history in sort of incredible wonkish detail of date labeling in America. But what it really boils down to is that at the federal level, there is only one product that has a standardized and required safety date on it, and that product is infant formula. And the reasons for that are that we obviously want to make sure infants who are on a formula diet don't experience any nutritional degradation or any kind of like texture changes in the formula that might cause a feeding and nutrition issue. Beyond that, every date you see at the federal level is a manufacturer's idea of when that product is at its peak or likely to be at its peak. At the state level, there's a variety of requirements on date labeling, typically for products that are considered highly perishable, like milk, like seafood, but those vary so widely and are not necessarily based on our current understandings of science or based on the type of refrigeration equipment that we now have in our cold chain. And so in many places, milk will be considered expired and unsellable on one end of a state or county line and perfectly good and saleable on the other end. Now, when it comes to consumer perception, those dates are really powerful. We've been trained for most of our lives to not eat anything past date, and we've sort of reduced our reliance on our own senses about how we assess whether a product is still good. We're very afraid of those pathogens that we can't see. And so it's really hard for consumers to get themselves comfortable with eating something, ingesting something, putting something into their body or the bodies of their children that they have like had that little seed of doubt planted about. And even my own husband, with me doing this work for years, has struggled with it and kind of will hand it to me and say, well, you smell it, you look at it. And he's getting a lot better over time, but we've seen how powerful that is, and there's a lot of research that's been done about that. So making that switch and standardizing that so that the dates that are true expiration dates are placed only on the kinds of products that are do present a potential risk, like for example, deli meats that could grow listeria over time in the back of your refrigerator and are eaten cold and not, you know, then therefore heat treated. Those are dates that would be good to really know, and then distinguish that from very clearly from the date on, say, a box of crackers or cereal, where you might taste something a little bit stale, but you're certainly not at risk.
So what would be involved in changing these laws?
Well, fortunately, there is a piece of federal legislation introduced by both Senator Blumenthal in the Senate and Representative Pingree in the House that would standardize that. And so that work has been done at the federal level. It's now just time to get some action and advocacy behind that bill so that it could be passed.
And before we go back to calls, we've got full lines. Nicole, what other policy changes would you like to see?
Well, that one is, I think, everyone's sort of number one, or most folks' number one who work in this space, because it would create such sweeping change. But there are so many others, and Representative Pingree, again, has been a real leader in this area. She introduced the Food Recovery Act, which is sort of a comprehensive omnibus bill with four titles that would make changes on the farm level, at the retail level, in restaurants and schools. And really look at this in a whole systems way. So provide everything from providing funding for anaerobic digestion and allowing composting on farms to be recognized as a conservation practice, to expanding the liability protections for people and organizations who donate food. And so that's one that I think is really, really important. And to make it not only based on donation. So right now there is a comprehensive liability protection for organizations that have excess wholesome food and donate it to people in need. And that's a wonderful thing that I've been kind of out there trying to educate people about. But it has some limitations in how it is structured. And it also doesn't apply to anyone who's doing cost-reduced retail or doing other things designed to prevent wholesome food from being wasted and maybe providing it at a very reduced rate. So I would love.
And what is the name of that legislation?
The Food Recovery Act.
And what is the status? Is this something that's controversial in Washington?
It's fortunately not that's controversial at all, which is really exciting. It has a fair amount of bipartisan momentum and support, but it's also the kind of bill that is very unlikely to sort of pass in whole cloth. And so what Representative Pingree will be really honest about when she talks about it is that she sort of introduces this legislation as a menu of options. She did this with the Local Food, Farm, and Jobs Act in advance of the 2012 Farm Bill. And as we are, or Farm Bill debate, and as we're gearing up for another Farm Bill debate, this is now kind of there and filed. The ideas are all out there. The language is out there. And so what I imagine will be most effective is to have a process of advocacy for particular pieces of this bill and to try to get them worked into other pieces of legislation, including the Farm Bill, but not just that, also Appropriations Acts and other things sort of in the sausage-making process of how we get laws made in Washington, to advocate for those pieces of it. So I've actually been working with young leaders and advocates on food recovery and food waste prevention, encourage them to review my summary of the bill, which I can give to your producer, and think about the pieces that are most important to them, and then call their representatives and seek movement on those pieces of the bill.
Hmm. Well, we will link to this piece of legislation. Alex, it seems like, I mean, if this issue got a lot more attention, it seems like people would be calling their representatives to urge them to vote for something like this.
Yeah, and that's the hope. And if you ever speak with Representative Pingree, that is kind of something that she actually advocates for. Absolutely.
And is there any other policy change that you would like to see?
I have to really echo what, you know, Dana mentioned earlier and now what Nicole's speaking about the expiration dates. That is something that, you know, I think is just so easy for us to do. And there's this movie called Just Eat It. Mm-hmm. If anyone's interested in any kind of movie on food waste, it's actually quite funny and it's very informative. And it's about this Canadian couple who tries to eat solely food waste for, I believe it's 6 months. And they go to the supermarket and they see three bottles of milk. They're the exact same label, the exact same product, 2%, I think it was. And one says use by, one says best buy, and one just says a date with no words. The exact same product from the exact same company, and they have different labels within the same company. So even the company's confused, right? It's not just the consumer. Hmm. So I think that's a real, you know, easy win for us.
Hmm. And it's called Just Buy It.
Just Eat It.
Just Eat It.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Just Eat It. That is Alex Strube. She is with Imperfect, a home and office produce delivery service focused on providing affordable fruits and vegetables that would otherwise be thrown away because they are considered, quote, ugly. They just celebrated their year anniversary. They've saved over 500,000 pounds of food, and they deliver all over the Bay Area. We're also joined by Nicole Civita, director of the Food Recovery Project at the University of Arkansas School of Law. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-700. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. So much awareness raising is going on now. How has that affected your relationship with food? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Darwin in Oakland. Hi, Darwin. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I think you guys are doing a really awesome service. I shop at Berkeley Bowl over in West Berkeley, and I before I go buy vegetables, I look at what we come to term the rotting food rack, finding all sorts of things every week. You know, bags of tomatoes for 99 cents that we just cook down into sauce and freeze. You know, I think that one of the big problems is that a lot of people find that they don't have the time, and I think that there has to be some re-education around people to spend, you know, to take the time to cook, you know, on a Saturday afternoon or part of the day anyway. But I really like the, that idea of Imperfect, and I think I'm going to have to sign up myself.
Please do.
Yes. That's it. I just wanted to say thank you. It's a great show.
Well, thank you so much, Darwin. And again, full disclosure, I've been getting Imperfect for about 2 months. If you like to cook, you will love, love this service. And even if you don't, you might try it out because you'll learn that just searching online, there are so many great, easy recipes. And Imperfect actually has pilot programs in grocery stores, right?
Yep.
Where you take a section of the produce department and you sell some of these, quote, ugly fruits and vegetables.
Yep. Our current pilot is with Whole Foods. We're in 11 stores right now and hopefully expanding to a few more. We right now in stores have potatoes and onions. We did have mandarins when citrus season was in its peak, and we'll hopefully be adding a few more SKUs and different products there.
And now Whole Foods is known for its high prices.
Yep.
And so how is Imperfect priced in Whole Foods?
Much lower. So our price is in general about 30 to 50% less than grocery stores. So when you get your produce box, you're paying 30 to 50% less than you would if you just went grocery shopping. And so we kind of maintain that equivalent pricing in Whole Foods.
And again, you can decide what you want and what you don't want. If you want 5 grapefruit and no zucchini, then that works. What about trying to make this accessible to low-income neighborhoods where,
yes,
in many cases, they don't even have a grocery store with fruits and vegetables?
Yes, the food deserts.
Right.
Absolutely.
There's so many around the Bay Area.
Yeah. I mean, I get off at West Oakland BART every day to go to work. We're in Emeryville. And even in Emeryville, you know, we have, you know, Darwin just mentioned Berkeley Bowl, but where we are is a food desert in a sense. We right now we just kind of submitted an application to be part of a pilot with the SNAP program. So right now SNAP is not able to transact online. And for those who are listening in, SNAP is the food stamp program. And so there's a little bit of a limitation there for online transactions and people to be able to use their food stamps to purchase fruits and vegetables or any food for that matter. Because we are not fully part of that program yet, and it might even be 6 months, 2 years, we don't really know, we do have a self-proclaimed low-income discount, which is an additional 33% off of your produce box. And it's just kind of like a trust program where you kind of list your family situation and we try to help you out, because the idea is that we want to get this food into the hands of those that really need it and want to have a healthier diet.
And we should also say that food stamps no longer exist because there was a stigma. So now it's basically a credit card that,
yep,
people use. And currently, you have to go into a physical store.
Right.
Right. In some cases, you can also use it at farmers markets.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And so this would allow people to buy an Imperfect box.
Right. And it's not just Imperfect. There's a few other companies that are also trying to get part of this pilot that do sell food products online.
What are your thoughts on that, Nicole? I mean, at a time when more than 20 pounds of food is wasted by every person in this country every single month, we've got, you know, massive hunger in this country. So what are your thoughts on how this solutions could get into the hands of people who really need it? I mean, the EPA introduced what they're calling a food recovery hierarchy. And how do we redirect that food that would otherwise be wasted to people who need it so badly?
Yeah, so there's a ton of really great, very inspiring activity happening at the community level and among particularly young and especially innovative entrepreneurs to take the situation we found ourselves in where our policies and our produce standards and our messy date labeling system generate this problem, and where our culture has also supported the problem, and working within that flawed framework, try to create sort of a very harmonious, mutually beneficial solution or series of solutions. And the things that I'm seeing are some really sophisticated food recovery or operations that then donate into food banks or local food shelves. I'm seeing people trying to figure out how to create a secondary market into cost-reduced retail. I'm seeing better community food sharing arrangements. And every time someone working on one of these projects comes to me with a legal question, it's typically, can I do this, or how can I do this, or will I be liable if there is truly something wrong with any of this food? How do I do this in a low-risk way, particularly because we're either operating as a nonprofit or on limited margins? And frankly, that's where some of the policy challenges come in, and we only kind of see them once someone has the idea to be really innovative. So Imperfect is trying to figure out how to make its service accessible to low-income people in the SNAP program, and that's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. And the question then becomes, okay, how is that logistically possible? And, I mean, I have a lot of faith that we can solve these problems bit by bit at the policy level. For example, for years, people weren't able to use their SNAP benefits to participate in a CSA, and that has since been addressed. And there is now a process for that. So I think when it comes to the government, which tends to just be a couple steps behind the innovation on the ground, it really is a case of advocating for those changes that we need to be this flexible, or advocating for larger scale structural change that allows our food system to function more efficiently and more justly. And by that, I really mean I am very impressed with it, with what Imperfect has done, and based on what I've heard today, I'm really also impressed with the fact that they're building relationships with farmers and relationships on both ends with consumers, so that they're working with the farmers to provide exactly what's in excess, not just what they think consumers want, and working with consumers to say, actually, if you give me those peppers, I'm going to waste them too. So I think the model is great. I've heard of a couple other programs and initiatives around the country that aren't quite as thoughtful and seem to be taking advantage of the fact that these produce standards are very wonky and purely cosmetically based, and leveraging that to do like sort of deep discounting on produce with the aim of making it more accessible, but sort of cutting out the farmers in the middle and not getting farmers the true value of what they need. At a time when our farmers are also often members of our food insecure population, I think it's really important to take a whole system approach, and as we think about these linkages and come up with sophisticated solutions that don't really unintentionally leave anybody else behind.
Well, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because most of the food eaten in this country is grown here in California. Talking about farmers, what about farm workers?
Yeah.
There's currently a bill on Governor Jerry Brown's desk that would, for the first time, give farm workers overtime. And Nicole, can you briefly talk about how all of this awareness raising and people actually buying food that would otherwise go to waste affects farm workers, who in many cases cannot afford to buy the food they pick?
Sure. I mean, at the moment, in the way we're structured, I don't think it will. But with bills like the one on Governor Brown's desk, it can. And largely the opposition to that bill and to others that seek to pay farm workers a more fair wage. I can't necessarily say living wage because we're so far away from that, but a more fair wage for the incredibly important work that they do, is that the farmers themselves, the landowners and the business operators themselves, are operating on such slim margins, and they simply couldn't afford to do this, or the cost of food would become far too high. And again, those are kind of complicated systems issues, but part of why farmers are operating on such thin margins are because the supply chain refuses to accept such a large percentage of the perfectly edible, very healthy food that they produce. And so by bringing additional revenue into farms, we can then more comfortably reallocate that revenue throughout the farm labor chain.
Well, we have time for just a few more callers. Let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show. Do we have Mark?
Hello, I'm on the speakerphone. Can you hear me?
Hi, Mark. Yes, hey. Go ahead.
Hi. I work with food service, so this is near and dear to my heart. And I had a couple of comments and questions. One was, we give away food at the end of our catered events. I'm a chef, with, you know, no questions asked. We were told there was a no Samaritan law that protected us. If we had faith that the food was good, we could not be prosecuted. And I wanted to hear about that. And also on the imperfect food, I was wondering if manufacturing was not utilizing this stuff already because of their machines needed to have uniform food. And I guess my third comment was, I do believe that the food being thrown away is more of an economy thing. It's not a semantic thing. We just waste food, and you have to pay for it. But I'm curious about the imperfect food being used by manufacturing. Is it already?
Yep. So there is a secondary market, a processor market for some typical produce. So that's, you know, carrots and apples are great examples of two pieces of produce that there is a real opportunity for them. And so, you know, there is a market, and they can go to processing.
And the juice market's exploding, so that makes
absolutely
sense,
there's
right?
A few juice companies out there that are actually, one is called Misfit Juicery, and they're using ugly fruits and vegetables to make juices. But there are a lot of pieces of produce that don't fit that, and there's also just such a huge amount. For example, we had serrano peppers in our boxes this week. It's really hard to move that many serrano peppers around and find a processor for that.
And because in addition to the, quote, ugly fruits and veggies, you also offer a surplus.
Yep.
Sometimes you're offering kale for $1.20 organic,
yep,
because there's just too much.
Right. And it could be number one kale. So that means
wow,
that it fits the perfect standards or what a retailer wants to see. It's just the farmer didn't really, you know, something happened in the seasonality and it was just a surplus.
And then quickly, what about the Good Samaritan law? Is that what it is?
Yes. The Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Food Donation Act was actually passed in 1996. So this has been around for a good long time now. And it exempts those who make good faith donations of food and grocery products that are apparently wholesome to nonprofit organizations that feed the hungry from liability and negligence for injuries associated with the consumption of that donated food. So it's a pretty comprehensive, very robust protection, and I've done this research over and over. It's the thing I think I'm most often quoted on. We've checked. Nobody's ever had to use it. There's never been a case where it's been implicated or raised as a defense, because this is not a terribly litigious area, despite people's sort of reticence around taking on any additional risk. The one challenge with this, and I should say that every state also has a companion act of its own that may even provide greater protection, but can't provide less protection than the federal level. But the one trick with this is that the Bill Emerson Act requires that the food that's donated comply with all relevant federal, state, and local quality and labeling standards in order for you to take advantage of this liability protection. And that's sort of like the little proviso that could undermine the coverage. You know, people worry that, well, what if my local health department has a rule that I didn't know about pertaining to donated food, or doesn't want me to donate a particular type of food, or needs it to be allergen labeled? Will that undermine this protection? And so, in fact, that's one of the things that Representative Pingree's Food Recovery Act is seeking to fix, so that you basically have to comply with state level law, but not the myriad of local health regulations.
Nicole, final thoughts. We've got just about 30 seconds. It seems like there's two levels here. As an individual, if you decide to buy these, quote, ugly fruits, I mean, you're saving, imperfect, over the last year saved over 500,000 pounds of food, which is incredible. But then you have these major policy changes that also need to be implemented.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a problem that we all own, that we're all kind of complicit in. It's also an opportunity for everyone to make a change. And every time you manage to cook that spinach before it gets wilted, or buy pieces of food that you might not otherwise have purchased, or that the grocery store might not have gotten, every time you recover food from a catering event or a restaurant and send it to be donated, you're making a really important impact. And I just hope that the folks who are starting to do that, who are starting to make that culture shift, also take a couple minutes to advocate for some of the larger structural changes in policy, and to make some of those cultural shifts, reminding people maybe in their family not to buy quite so much, or expecting their corner store to be so fully stocked.
That is a great point. Nicole Civita is director of the Food Recovery Project at the University of Arkansas School of Law. Alex Stroob is with Imperfect, and they deliver produce that would otherwise be thrown away all over the Bay Area. They just celebrated their year anniversary. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Nicole and Alex, thank you for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our media roundtable. This week, on our last roundtable of the year, we'll discuss the media's mostly uncritical coverage of Donald Trump and what they've learned from his Electoral College victory. What has changed since the election? We'll also discuss the role of journalism in today's fragmented media landscape. What journalism stood out this year, and where did the media fall short? Join us at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Helena Murphy is our researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.